of the words.
They did most of the talking, I explained. The captain said he wanted to capture me, to breed me. He said he could sell a line of new warriors with my DNA.
You'd like that, Turov commented.
The idea had its appeal, I admitted. But as a man of duty and honor, I took the hard way out and tried to blast them all to hell and back instead.
Winslade snorted and clasped his hands together. His eyes were half shut with suspicion whenever he looked at me.
James, Turov said, it's vitally important you make a full and complete report to me concerning your interaction with the enemy. Something small, even a minor detail, might be valuable to Earth Intel.
For the first time since I'd walked into her office, her words troubled me. I'd planned to wake up and go back to my old routine, all the while staying quiet about what Captain Torrent had said. But Turov had a point. The squids were our enemies, and they'd given me information whether I'd promised Torrent to hold on to it or not. I said. What do you think of a promise made as a matter of honor, sir? I asked her, seriously. Turov frowned.
You promised to stay quiet? You promised this to a cephalopod officer?
I was in difficult circumstances, I pointed out.
Ah, then such a promise is not ethically binding. Is that not right, Primus Winslade?
He looked us both over, shaking his head.
I can't believe you're even taking this seriously, Imperator. Order this disrespectful non-com to brief us on what happened. Anything less would be conduct unbecoming. Answer my question, Primus,
Turov said sternly.
About the ethics of the situation? Of course it works that way. You can't torture a man into confession and have it be legally binding, at least not in a civilized society. You can't extract contracts or promises from a man under any kind of duress. That isn't honor, it's force.
I thought such words were ironic, coming from Primus Winslade, the torture master. But even so, his points made sense to me. I was still a bit troubled, but I decided to tell them what had transpired. They listened closely as I described my interactions with Captain Torrent. They were particularly interested in the details of how and why the cephalopods came to be committed to defending the Wurr.
Very odd, Turov said. They don't like the Wurr. In fact, they are in a state of war with them. But still, they continue to protect them.
I don't think that's quite what's happening, I said. I think Claver lied about the war between the squids and the plants. That war is over, and the plants won. I explained further about Torrent's description of the squid queens captured on their thrones. Back on Machine World, I said, do you recall that giant squid we found in a cold tank down in the lowest tunnels?
Of course, Turov said. Your idiot friend Ortiz blew it apart.
I believe that was later determined to be a matter of self-defense.
Turov rolled her eyes.
Yes, that lie was in the report, as I recall. Well, what about the giant squid?
It was female, I said. All the others we've met up with, every soldier, officer, you name it, have been male.
Turov squinted at me.
Are you saying it was a queen?
Makes sense to me.
She moved to her desk and leaned her butt up against it. I caught Winslade eyeing her from behind. I couldn't blame him.
That means the queens, their females, are rare, she said thoughtfully. Anything necessary and rare is important. Could the plants have won the war by capturing critical members of the cephalopod species?
I shrugged. Could be. It's certainly worth reporting to Central. If I don't miss my guess, the Xeno freaks back home on Earth will get the shakes over it when they hear these details.
Right, she said. Good thinking, James. I'll make sure to deliver that information personally.
That was Turov in a nutshell. She was going to deliver her findings, my findings, all prettied up with a bow on top.
she'd take credit and reach for more rank. It was her standard operating procedure. But I didn't care. I wasn't much of a rank climber myself. What I was happy about was the probability this tidbit would get her off my back. The central display began beeping, as did Turov's tapper. She frowned, but answered the call.
"What is it?"
she snapped.
"I gave orders that I wasn't..."
"Imperator, the cephalopod captain is attempting to open a channel to your office."
Turov's butt flew off her desk. She worked the screen, and a moment later, the ugly, gold-collared Captain Torrent flickered into being in all his glory. She gave me a stern glance.
"Stay off camera, and stay quiet."
I nodded. Even I knew Torrent might not be thrilled to see me in the background during any negotiation. Captain Torrent's eyes swept the scene, but I positioned myself where the cameras wouldn't pick me up. I could see his wet, pinkish-brown skin was pockmarked with wounds. He'd been injured. One of his eyes was drooping and weeping a bit, too. Probably my plasma grenade had picked up grit, turning it into needle-like shrapnel, and blasted him with it. As far as I was concerned, it couldn't have happened to a nicer alien.
"Imperator Turov," he said, "an accident has occurred. The Nexus were on this planet has ceased to function."
"A pity."
"Your odd word translates to a small matter. We do not agree with your assessment. This matter is a significant one, a dishonorable failure from our species."
Turov nodded. I could see the wheels turning inside her head. She was trying to come up with a way to gain an advantage in the situation, but she was also being cautious.
"What action will you take next?"
she asked.
"You have no right to demand such information."
"I didn't mean to..."
"However," continued Torrent, "in the spirit of investment, I'm willing to share information with inferiors such as you, beings that might yet prove useful to the kingdom. We're leaving this system. Please inform your crew and all the other slave candidates awaiting our leadership on your home world. The Wur Garden that once enveloped this planet will wither and die without Nexus guidance. Therefore, there is nothing left here to protect. Our mission has ended."
"A most unfortunate accident," Turov said. "We offer our condolences for your loss."
Torrent looked at her quizzically.
"Your words have no meaning. We've suffered a loss, but there is no translation for the concept you connected to that fact. No matter, we will be your masters in the end. This discussion is at an end."
Torrent disconnected abruptly.
"What a dick," I said.
Turov looked at me and Winslade thoughtfully.
"Did you notice? They have no words for pity or condolences. You're right, James. They're truly unpleasant creatures."
"Did you see his eye?"
I asked, proudly. "He took a hit there. I bet my bottom credit it was shrapnel from my grenade that did that." She looked at me closely.
"You did kill the Nexus, as I requested. What's more, after talking to the cephalopods, you sent them packing into space. I'm quite impressed, McGill."
Winslade squirmed uncomfortably.
"That's like thanking a cat for pissing on the curtains," he said. "McGill only did what came naturally to him. Deceit, violence, such things are all in a day's work for—" "Conceal your jealousy, Primus."
Turov uttered the words without looking at him.
"You're embarrassing yourself."
Winslade got to his feet, looking annoyed.
"Permission to get back to my duties, sir." "Granted. Pack up your cohort. The squid ship is gone. The plants are dying. Correspondingly, we're going to board and retake Minotaur in the morning."
Winslade looked startled.
"Is that wise, sir?" "I said it, didn't I?"
He fidgeted, but then he nodded at last.
"We attack in the morning. May I make one suggestion?"
"If you must."
"We should leave the revival machine here, along with a protective unit, just in case the assault force is lost. They could rebuild the Legion if things went badly. That way Varus wouldn't be wiped out."
Imperator Turov looked at him suspiciously.
"And who would you recommend be left in command of this unit on the ground?"
"Well, sir, I wouldn't want to delegate such a critical mission to amateurs. I'd be willing to take on the assignment myself."
"Of course you would. Dismissed."
Winslade left, and I was glad to see him go. Smiling an odd smile, Galena came to me and sat in my lap. When my hands came up to reach for her, she slapped me a hard one across the face. I looked at her questioningly.
"You're becoming insolent," she said.
"I wanted to shoot you when you sprawled yourself out in this chair like a child. Winslade knows we're having an affair. It's affecting his performance." I scoffed. "I think you'll find my performance hasn't diminished in the least." My arms came up again, and this time she allowed them to encircle her. She squirmed a little, but she let me touch her. Things progressed quickly, as they always did with Galena. After making doubly sure the desktop display was turned off and not recording anything, she leaned on it and let me have my way with her, right then and there. After we were finished, she walked primly around to the other side of the desk, her clothes re-knitted over her as I watched. I was sorry to see her soft skin vanish under cloth.
"That was the last time, James," she said.
My jaw sagged. "Really?"
"Yes. People are beginning to talk. I find that annoying. Please don't be distraught."
I felt an urge to laugh at the idea that I would cry about losing her, but I knew enough to hold that back. Sure, I liked our get-togethers, what man wouldn't? But I'd never been one to fool myself into thinking she seriously cared about me. The best I could hope for was an even break now and then. "I'm surprised, not hurt," I said. "Women don't dump me all that often, not without a good reason anyway."
"Yes,"
she said.
"Usually you forget about them and wander off. Just as often they catch you cheating and become angry. Don't you think it's better for both of us to end it this way instead, as adults?"
Thinking, I stuck out my chin and nodded. "Good enough. I guess I'll be going. But there's one more thing, Galena."
"What is it?"
"Did you mean what you said about being impressed by my actions in the field?" She met my eyes evenly.
"Absolutely. Compared to you, Winslade is a worm under a rock."
I knew she was right, of course, but hearing it from someone in command was good for the spirit. Galena Turov was as ruthless as they came, and she didn't pull any punches. That said, I felt I could count on her to say what she thought was the truth most of the time. Happy with her honest praise, I smiled all the way out of the lifter and back to my squad. Chapter 41. The next morning we launched an all-out assault. Minotaur had been squatting in space over Death World for about a week now. In all that time it hadn't shifted orbit or responded to transmissions other than in the most rudimentary automated fashion. Fortunately, the dreadnought was far enough out in space to stay stable. The orbit hadn't decayed, so it wasn't in danger of falling and crashing yet. The techs had already calculated we had around 2 years before that happened, but we weren't interested in waiting around any longer than we had to. We loaded up 400 troops, carrying the best of the gear we had left. We left Winslade and about 200 troops behind, camped on the endless green expanse of grass that had begun to grow over the scorched land. Turov had assigned him a single combat unit, which was made up of poorly equipped recruits.
They had a few bunkers and drones and, of course, the revival unit. Winslade was all smiles and waving as we took off and left him. You'd have thought we were loved ones going on a cruise. Anne, Natasha, and most of the other non-combatants were left planet-side with Winslade. There would be time enough to ferry them to Minotaur later, assuming that we were able to recapture her. All attention turned toward our goal once the cloud cover enveloped the world below us. I was up in the command center with Turov, Tribune Drusus, and Captain Graves. That was quite an honor for me. I didn't know why they'd taken me up there, unless it was because there was plenty of room. The briefing chambers were meant to hold all the officers in a full cohort. Turov, as usual, spoke first.
I want to tell you all that I have the utmost confidence in the highly experienced troops Legion Varus has left, she said, looking from one centurion to the next. I'm only sorry that we could not bring more troops. It would take months to revive the whole Legion, and this lifter is only capable of transporting a single cohort.
A centurion named Martinez spoke up. She was a stocky woman with her hair pulled back so tightly her eyebrows were halfway up her forehead.
We could have waited one more week at least, she said. Then we'd have 1,000 troops rather than 400.
Turov looked at her flatly.
Yes, but we don't have guns for that many men. In that same period of time, we don't know how much stronger the enemy aboard the ship might grow. They might even gain control of the ship and maroon us here.
Tribune Drusus cleared his throat. Turov glanced at him and nodded.
Now, she said, I'm going to turn planning over to our master tactician, Tribune Drusus.
She stepped away from the central console, and Drusus stepped forward. The officers relaxed, visibly. Drusus was far more experienced in this area. I considered it a wise move on her part to relinquish control.
Thank you, Imperator, Drusus said. I've been studying this problem since we first learned Minotaur had been overrun. Here's the ship in detail.
He brought up a three-dimensional display of the vessel and spun it around with his fingertips so that we were looking at the stern region.
As best we can tell, the enemy pierced the thick hull surrounding the engine core. This took time, but when they finally made it through, they were able to do enough damage to poison the atmosphere of the ship. As we watched, a simulation of poisonous gas flooded the ship. The decks were each displayed in their appropriate color, gold for the combat level, green for the central exercise zone, and blue for the bio level. These decks were sealed at first, but with the help of the invading aliens, the gas spread from zone to zone until the entire ship was affected.
This scenario is supposition, of course, Drusus said. But we know from models that it could have happened this way, especially given the alien capacity to excrete acids that burn through metal quickly. Taken by surprise, most of our troops would have succumbed to the radiation and poisoned air. The rest were probably killed by the invaders themselves. We watched in grim silence as deck by deck the ship was invaded and all resistance extinguished. I felt a fresh surge of hatred for the Wurr, and I had to wonder how many desperate troops had fought to the death on Minotaur. Cut off and dying, I was sure our troops had done their damnedest. But it hadn't been enough.
That's all history, Drusus said, watching our grim faces. Here's the plan to retake the ship. We'll start here, at Green Deck. The upper dome is shielded with a heavy blast dome. But we can disable that from the outer hull and get the clamshell dome to open. After that, all we have to do is puncture the inner transparent bubble and enter the ship. There were surprised looks all around. Martinez spoke up again.
But won't that release the atmosphere, sir? Explosive decompression will result if there are any survivors.
If there are, we doubt we'll find them on Green Deck. Think about it. These are plants. Where do you think the Wurr are most likely to have taken up residence?
Moreover, the atmosphere inside the ship has been compromised already. We'll have to release it all anyway to begin the cleanup process. Martinez nodded. She retreated a step and said nothing more. I understood how she felt. The situation was terrible. All this time, down here on the planet's surface, we'd been too busy to think about how the rest of our legion had fared. But now we were going to be confronted with the gruesome realities. There had to be thousands of dead. They'd been left rotting for a week inside our ship. Even if we could retake Minotaur, we were going to have a hell of a time making the ship livable again. There wasn't much argument after that. People got their assignments and they left one by one to brief their teams. Each unit got a specific mission, either to capture a critical zone of the ship or to search and destroy enemy combatants.
McGill,
Drusus said at last. Here, sir, I said. I'd been hanging back in a shadowy region near a curving bulkhead. There were only a few people left in the chambers, so I walked up to the central console.
There you are. It's not like you to hide.
No, sir. What can I do for you? Drusus eyed me strangely.
I've got a special mission for you. I want you to get to Gold Deck and secure this area.
He leaned over the table and zoomed in on the map of the ship. A region blinked red. It was part of Gold Deck, way out along the starboard side. Storage Locker 6, sir, I said, reading the label that popped up between us.
That's it. There should be something useful there, or right near that location. A combat vehicle.
It was about then I noticed Turov. She was staring at me from her seat in a chair behind Drusus. She looked like a cat eyeing a bird on the wrong side of a plate glass window. That look, on this particular woman's face, made me nervous.
A combat vehicle, sir? You mean a dragon?
That's right.
I thought we left all the dragons.
McGill, are you refusing this mission? He asked.
No, sir, not at all. I can see how a dragon might be useful. I accept the mission, sir.
I'll inform Graves.
That was it. I walked out, headed to my squad in the hold, and sat down with them.
Sargon was the first one to notice that I had an odd look on my face.
What's up, boss?
He asked, frowning.
Nothing, I said. But we've got a special op coming.
I explained it to him and the rest of the squad. They were left scratching their heads with me.
Let me get this straight, Carlos said. Your girlfriend sent you to Gold Deck to get her shoes, is that it?
Shut up, specialist, I said. Keevy perked up at the mention of the word girlfriend. She looked from me to Carlos and back again.
Girlfriend? On Gold Deck? McGill, don't tell me you've been fooling around with Turov again. I thought you'd buried that evil relationship back on Tech World.
Think again, Carlos said unhelpfully. Actually, I can't believe you didn't already know, Keevy. You need to get online more. There are chat line reports and even a few blurry snaps taken by suit cameras.
What?
I demanded.
Of all the dirty, underhanded...
Luckily, they aren't underhanded. Carlos said, showing me his tapper. At least you have your clothes on. Turov's hair looks a little funny in this shot, though, as you two are coming out of her office together. That's a dead giveaway, McGill. Unprofessional.
A blurry shot of me kissing the Imperator was displayed on Carlos's arm. I had no idea who'd taken it. Hell, it might have been a buzzer on the wall for all I knew.
That's the trouble with pinhead cameras flying around everywhere, I complained.
Keevy's face pushed between us and she got a good look.
Damn it, she said. You're a fool, that's all I have to say. You're not going to get anything out of that relationship other than friction with everyone in the Legion.
Ha ha, burst out Carlos. Friction. McGill's all over that.
There's no relationship, Keevy, I said, but... That sounded weak, even to me. Still, I had to try. We're not seeing each other anymore. It was just a weak moment caught on camera.
Oh, so you admit that you were seeing her? Keevy asked, shaking her head.
Hey, Carlos said, nudging me.
Check this out.
Knowing I shouldn't, I saw him swipe to a brief vid. This one showed me coming out of the Imperator's quarters, not her office. This time, neither of us was entirely dressed, and she had a beverage in her hand.
Shit, I said. Look at it this way, McGill, he said. At least she's smiling.
I grabbed his arm and tapped the delete button while he chuckled. A few moments later, he showed me he had it back again.
What the hell? I demanded. It's on a server somewhere, in a cache, floating on a cloud, whatever. Give it up, McGill. You're famous. The good stuff never dies on the net.
Knowing he was right, I sat glumly for the rest of the flight. I decided to ignore them. After all, I'd done it, and they couldn't be expected to let it go. Sometimes there were things that superseded the chain of command. I couldn't squelch their fun without turning into a raging dick, and they didn't deserve that. So I suffered the ribbing until it died down, then turned to business, giving out tactical assignments. I don't have to remind you all that this is do or die, I told them when I had their full attention again. We're sitting in the last lifter. Our legion is over 90% dead. The enemy strength is unknown, but it was enough to kill everyone aboard when they invaded. They began to sober up as they listened to my words. The odds were bleak. Legionnaires, particularly those who had the misfortune to sign up with Legion Varus, aren't strangers to death. But that didn't mean we liked dying.
Chapter 42. The opening stages of the boarding action went smoothly enough. Minotaur hung in space, a derelict. Emergency flashers along the hull blinked slowly, showing the ship was in distress. Even more ominous was the constant pinging tone that hit our headsets every 10 seconds. It was on every channel, a powerful signal that rhythmically informed us the ship was in dire trouble. No one aboard had bothered to turn it off, and as we weren't aboard yet, we couldn't either. It was the best evidence yet that the entire crew was dead. Who would have let that signal continue beeping for a solid week without acknowledging and canceling it? As we got closer to the ship, the tone pinged louder. It set my teeth on edge, and I had my crew lower the volume of their headsets' general channel and increase the volume on the squad channel. We could still hear the distress call, but it no longer interfered with our conversations. Our lifter spun around and began braking, setting up to land on the massive dreadnought's hull. The lifter was the most vulnerable at this stage of the game. If the enemy had gained control of the anti-ship weaponry, well, we were all as good as dead. Gritting our teeth and listening to that incessant pinging, we waited until the transport came to rest on Minotaur's hull. We felt the transport shiver as clamps were applied.
"We're down, and we're good,"
Graves announced to the unit. His words were met with a ragged cheer. All around me, troops clutched their morph rifles and double-checked their suit integrity.
"All right," Graves said. "We're pumping all the air out of the lifter now, storing it in tanks for later. Prepare for hard vacuum."
I could already hear the steady hiss of escaping air. It grew in intensity, and it seemed to me that I could feel cold spots inside my armor. I don't think a space suit has ever been made that didn't have hot and cold spots in it under extreme conditions. Some of our suits were pretty banged up, and they didn't always work perfectly. My armor, for example, liked to pool up water in the lower left corner of my visor while in zero G. It was really sweat and steam from my exhalations and not overly dangerous, but it did demonstrate that the dehumidifiers weren't operating at 100%.
"They tell me from the bridge that the outer clamshell controls have been accessed from an external port,"
Graves said, relaying what he was hearing from the brass channel.
"We're working with the AI to convince it to open up. That could be difficult if the transparent dome over Green Deck is compromised. The AI is programmed to prevent decompression."
"No shit," Carlos said to me. "Next he'll tell us the whole plan to break in through the glass is tits up. Then we'll have to go in using those acid holes the plants bored through the hull. You see if I'm..."
"Shut up, Ortiz," I said.
For once, he did as I asked. No one wanted to hear about all the crap that could go wrong. We weren't on our first mission in space. We knew it was the most deadly environment any man could have the misfortune to fight in. A rumble went through the ship. Everyone put their right hand on their buckles and gripped their rifles with the left. Carlos looked at me, and I could see he was scared. "Remember the first time they pumped the air out of a lifter on us?" I asked him, smiling.
"Oh, yeah. How could I forget our first shared death experience? Graves is still a cold-hearted bastard. How can he maintain such a grim life after all these years? I mean, wouldn't you get tired of it?"
I waited for a second, but he didn't answer his own question.
"I expect it gets into a man's blood," I told him. "After a few decades, it's all he knows."
Carlos looked down at the deck. Debris floated around us, discarded ammo, dangling straps and wires. What looked like a perfectly secured environment on the ground was rarely clean in space, once everything started to drift in the air.
"You think we'll end up like Graves?" he asked, "not caring if we live or die?"
Frowning, I strained my brain for a few seconds, but as luck would have it, I didn't need to come up with an answer. Yellow flashers began rotating. The ramp was going down.
"Legionnaires," Graves said in our helmets. "We're going to move out in an organized fashion. Double-check your magnetics. If I see a man floating off with one of my last full sets of equipment into deep space, I'll shoot him in the ass."
The ramp lowered into the silence of space. The atmosphere was gone, so while we could feel the motors with our butts, we couldn't hear them with our ears. The harsh starlight of L-374 shone like a beacon as the ramp lowered. When the ramp was fully deployed, we slapped the central button on our safety belts, and they fell away. We got up en masse, but at first we could hardly move. There were lots of troops ahead of my squad this time. As close as I could figure it, we were going to get off the lifter in the very last wave. Up ahead, troops exited in a steady stream, scrambling into the glare of the local star. The reflections from their helmets were dazzling.
"Is that clamshell open?" Sargon said. "I never heard Graves say. Does anyone know?"
"It's clear,"
Kivi said.
"The embedded techs are talking. Lots of techs have buzzers now. Should I deploy one, veteran?"
I glanced at her. I knew she had 20 of them, but sending one out early was technically a waste. In open space, they couldn't use their wings. The tiny drones had to expend puffs of fuel to fly, and they had a very limited supply of that. Opening my mouth to deny her request, I had a second thought. For purposes of morale, it would be good to see what we were going up against.
"Fly one," I said. "Just one, mind you, and pipe the feed to everyone in the squad."
She hurried to obey. A few seconds later, my tapper displayed an over-the-shoulder view of the lines of troops. The image slewed and moved rapidly. With sickening speed, it zoomed past the helmets of 100 troops and out into the open. I watched my tapper in fascination. Open space. There wasn't anything around other than Minotaur and the colorful disk of Death World itself below us. I could see the clamshell drawn back and displaying the inner layer of hardened polymer that kept the cold void outside the ship. Along the rim of the dome, a growing throng of soldiers spread out. They were walking oddly, using their magnetic boots to keep them anchored to the metal hull. As we watched, a weaponeer in the lead squad fired his gun at the polymer sheet the troops were encircling. The effect was immediate and alarming. The ruptured surface exploded outward like a massive sheet of glass in slow motion. I could see air and water vapor escaping into space like a geyser. The mix frosted into a trillion ice crystals and began to coat the onlookers who stood too close to the edge. Up until that moment, everything had gone exactly according to plan. We'd flown up from Death World to Minotaur, docked, opened the clamshell, and punctured the dome. Honestly, I'd begun to hope that despite everything, we'd recapture the ship without a loss. Minotaur looked to be devoid of any life at all. What if the radiation had killed the Wurr as surely as it had killed the Legion and the crew? That would be a best-case scenario. And up until now, it had seemed possible. But then, As the air vented and the troops fell back from the fury of the blasting gases, I felt a rumble beneath my feet. Through Keevy's drone, I could now see what it was. The two halves of the clamshell dome, the blast shields that normally covered Green Deck, were beginning to close again. For about a second, no one reacted. The two metal half-domes rolled up. The motion appeared to be slow from the point of view of the drone, but to people out there on the hull, it was moving pretty fast. Two figures were lifted up and tossed into space. They tumbled, ejected by the force of the moving dome. A few other figures were even less lucky. They were entangled in debris, and as the metal crescents rose, they were crushed to a pulp.
"Emergency!" shouted Graves. "Everyone out of the lifter. Board Minotaur now, any way you can. That's an order."
We surged forward. The organized, shuffling mass of troops turned into a wild flood. I glanced one last time at my tapper to glimpse the view Keevy was relaying from her drone. Troops were throwing themselves into the geyser of escaping gas, fighting against the pressure to get inside. The geyser was visibly weaker now. But with nothing for the invading troops to push against, they were having a hard time overcoming that gushing current. Meanwhile, the clamshells were still moving, shutting themselves at a steady rate. I could tell from the look of the choked-up group ahead of us that we weren't even going to make it to the exit before Minotaur closed up again.
"Squad!" I shouted. "Everyone release your magnetics and jump up! Climb on the ceiling, hand over hand!"
They hesitated until they saw me do as I'd ordered. Then they followed my lead. Moving as fast as I could, I dragged myself over the ceiling, which was webbed with storage nets and the like. Employing this tactic, we at least made it to the ramp. Behind me, I could see others adopting my approach. The ceiling of the lifter was thronged with troops who were moving like spiders.
"What do we do when we get out into the open?" Carlos demanded from behind me. "Just throw ourselves out into space?"
"Yes, launch yourselves like you can fly. When you're over the dome, open the external venting valve on your secondary air tank. Make sure the nozzle is aimed toward open space opposite your angle of flight. Use it like propellant. Remember that trick from VAC training?"
"Hell no," Carlos answered.
"Well, it will work. Open up your spare tank and let it push you downward. That's an order."
They grumbled, and I could hear a lot of rapid, almost panicky breathing over their microphones.
No one liked the idea of expending their limited air supply as a propellant, but they didn't openly refuse. I launched first, as I was the man in front. I think in retrospect I kicked off too hard. It was like pushing off from the wall of a pool and gliding forward, only in space there was no water to slow me down. Soaring like a bird, I flew over the heads of 100 struggling troops. I could see ahead that the dome was more than half shut. The jaws of the blast shield were coming together, and soon whoever was caught in them would be crushed. Up high, the two halves of the dome were farther apart. I glided into this space, and the light of L-374 was shut out immediately. Stark shadow enclosed me, and I could feel the cold of it right through my suit. A steady hiss began as I employed my spare tank. I fired it behind me and a little upward. The force began to push me down. Still, I could see I wasn't going to make it. I was moving too fast. Before I could slow down, I was going to fly right out the other side of the closing dome.
"Squad, deploy the tank early," I shouted. "I might not make it. My tank isn't providing enough counter thrust."
"I'm in," said Keevy. "I can see you, Miguel. You're too high."
Cursing, I struggled and looked around for a solution. It's hard to think while spinning. Worse, my helmet blocked much of my vision. I couldn't look over my shoulder, and I could barely see down into the dome. Finally, I came up with a plan at the last second. I opened my main tank. That did the trick. I shot down into the clamshell, and they closed silently over me, shutting out the light of the star and most of our troops. I quickly closed both tanks and checked the oxygen levels. I thudded gently into the closed dome and pushed off it to sail down toward the others. They were peering down through the breach into the dark unknown that was Green Deck. Joining them, I took stock of my situation. We were officially aboard Minotaur. But that's where the good news ended. half my squad had been left outside, along with two-thirds of all our invading troops. Even better, I was down to 3 hours of air. Tops. Chapter 43. Vac suits provide good protection against radiation. They have to, because open space is full of exotic particles and dangerous flares of invisible light. Accordingly, one of the first things I checked when I stopped spinning around was my suit's radiation counter. Minotaur was ticking hot, but the dose was far from lethal.
"Looks like the evacuation of the atmosphere worked," Graves said. "Radiation levels are down. Let's have a head count. Who made it in here?"
We sounded off by squads, and I gathered my people while maneuvering toward the broken spot in the dome. As the pressure had just equalized, it was no longer firing a geyser up into our faces. Looking down, I didn't see a forested area like I'd hoped to. First off, it was dark down there. Secondly, the trees I could make out looked dead and stripped down to the bare wood. Had the plant life eaten them?
Graves said, "We're out of touch with 70% of the unit. After checking with members of the other units, however, I've found they did even worse. As I'm the senior officer present, I'm taking over tactical command until this action is over, or until someone higher ranked manages to get inside the hull."
No one objected to the idea of Graves taking command. In fact, we were happy. Graves was a good man to have behind you in an unknown and possibly grim situation. If Turov had made it into the dome instead, I'd have been worried. Her record wasn't the best in tough tactical actions. Graves marshaled us quickly. He sent a few scouts down to the floor of Green Deck, then folded squads and platoons together. It soon became apparent there was only about a combined unit's worth of legionnaires inside Minotaur. Only 100 or so of us had made it through the closing blast shield alive. Harris was one of those who hadn't made it. Della was one of the few members of his team who had made it in, and she was folded into my squad. Of my original group, I had Carlos, Keevy, Lau, and Gorman. The rest had to be too slow getting inside the closing dome, or they'd died trying. When we were organized, Graves contacted me directly.
"McGill, how do you manage to get your people in here?"
he demanded.
"I put you at the back of the bus so you wouldn't cause trouble."
"I've never liked the bus, Centurion," I said. Then I quickly told him how we'd done it. He was amused.
"Never heard of a man so eager to get himself killed,"
he chuckled.
"I like that. Take point, madman."
For a moment, I debated telling him about my oxygen supply situation, but I passed on that. I had a few hours left, after all, and reporting my technical difficulties before they stopped me from following my orders seemed weak. Instead, I dove for the ragged opening, and my hodgepodge squad dove after me. We sailed down into Stygian darkness. Dead leaves, corpses, and even globules of ice floated around us.
"Look at our stripped trees," Carlos said. "The alien plants must have eaten them. Disgusting freaks. They're like an army of giant slugs."
"The balls of ice are beautiful in a way," Della said. "They must be from the lake in the center of the artificial forest. It's so strange to see it frozen into balls and left floating in the dark."
"The ship's plumbing system automatically sucks most of the water down into holding tanks before battle," I told her. "But this time, they clearly didn't get it all. Della, can you dive into that empty pond and see if there's anything alive down there?" She was the fastest troop I had, even in zero-G. There was something about growing up on a barbaric alien planet that made a person tougher than usual. I couldn't help but admire her form as she grabbed a tree branch and swung around it like a gibbon. Before she could push off, however, the branch she was on snapped. It was brittle with cold, but she managed to get her legs around the trunk. The rest of us watched as she shimmied all the way to the ground and then darted over a cliff wall, vanishing. We waited for about 10 seconds. Then another 20. I'd just begun to frown and open my mouth to ask if she was okay when she radioed back to me.
"'It's nothing from Earth down here,' she said. "'Even the water plants are dead.'
When she first said that, I naturally assumed that she was talking about algae and the like, but when I launched down and joined her, I was in for a surprise. The whole lake bed, some 100 meters across, was full of alien pods. Every inch of the sandy bottom was replanted with hulking, bulbous growths. Fortunately, they all seemed to be as dead as the earthly plants were. Around the lake bed, there were still trees from Earth, but all of them were stripped to bare wood like looming skeletons. The plants that were in better shape resembled those I'd seen back on Death World. For some reason, the sight appalled me. I'd always liked Green Deck. It pissed me off that these damned aliens had taken it upon themselves to uproot our greenery and replace it with their own. It just didn't seem right. "Centurion Graves," I transmitted. "McGill reporting. The enemy is here, at least in pod form. The pods appear to have been frozen to death by depressurization, however."
"Say again, McGill," Graves asked. "Do you see enemy troops?"
"No, sir, not exactly. We're surrounded by alien pods and vines, and I'm certain we didn't plant them here. Fortunately, they're frozen stiff."
"Interesting. It sounds like the radiation released from the core didn't kill them, but the hard vacuum did. I'm bringing the rest of the unit down to your position."
We poked around for a time as the unit formed around us. We had to use our hands to pull ourselves around on the dead vines until we found a big iron pipe. We figured it must have been the one that drained the water while Minotaur was in flight. Walking on it with our magnetic boots activated, we managed to reach the main exit. There, we were in for another surprise. The exit had been sealed.
"Weapons at the ready, soldiers,"
Graves said, hand over handing it along our line to the front. He grabbed each man's helmet or air hose and pulled himself over our heads. It was a strange way to move, but it worked well. He used his gauntlets to grab onto our suits and pull himself along. In zero-G training, we'd learned a number of techniques, and we were using them all now. Another trick was to use our magnetic boots to walk on another man's armor. There was a lot of titanium in our suits, but there were steel components, too. Graves inspected the exit, which looked like it had been welded shut.
"Is Natasha here?"
"No, sir," I said. "Turov left her back on Death World."
"Great. What have we got in the way of Tex?"
A few came forward. Graves recognized Kivi and selected her. He directed her to inspect the edges of the metal and give an expert opinion. I could tell right off Kivi was nervous. She'd only been a tech for a short time, and her background knowledge didn't extend much past whatever it took to get through tech school. Natasha, on the other hand, had been a hardcore science geek her whole life.
"I'm not sure,"
Kivi said after letting her light play over the strange weld-like fusing of metal that ringed the exit.
"If I had to guess, I'd say they used their secreted acid. Maybe they're able to apply it lightly over two surfaces, melting them together. Then they might chemically neutralize the reaction. That would cause the metal to fuse like this. But it's only a guess."
"Good enough," Graves said. "Weaponeers, destroy this door. Everyone else take hold of something solid. There's likely to be a blast of gas if the corridor beyond is pressurized."
Those of us who were near the door hastened to get out of the way. Three belchers emitted lances of fire the moment we were clear. The door turned white hot in an instant, then melted into a burning incandescent radiance. The metal burned like a giant sparkler, and a hole opened up in the center. A gush of released gas flowed out of the hole, but it wasn't as powerful as when we'd opened Green Deck to space.
"McGill, give me a quick recon."
I scuttled forward, and once I stepped through the white-hot breach, I felt weight return to my limbs. That was a relief. The passage didn't provide anything like a full G of gravity, but it was enough to keep me on the ground. Behind me, my squad hurried to keep up. We had our rifles up to our faceplates, ready to tear up anything we saw. "It's a mess inside, sir," I said. "Empty space suits, dead plants, debris... I'd say there was a fight in here, all right."
"No sign of active resistance?"
"None, sir.
Unit forward.
We pressed on. The one thing that surprised me was the lack of bodies. There were a few, but not as many as I'd expected there to be. What's more, when we investigated those we found, we discovered they were empty suits, and not dead men at all.
Where are all the bodies? Carlos demanded. What did these green bastards do with them?
Why don't you find one and ask him?
Kiwi suggested. Carlos turned to frown at her, and there might have been an argument if Graves hadn't called to us over the unit-wide channel.
Unit, halt. The central passageway appears to be clear. I'm going to switch over to our original invasion plan. Each unit with specialized orders will now carry them out. Graves out.
What the frig?
Carlos said loudly.
Is he crazy? There's only about 100 of us left, and he wants us to break up and get lost in the ship?
Our mission is to recapture this vessel, I told him. Our original operational orders were designed to do just that. Gather up, people. Our squad's target is Gold Deck. We'll take this duct leading upward as a shortcut. In addition to powered lifts, there were tubes with ladders in them to allow access between decks. We found one that went up. We slung our rifles on our backs and shimmied into the tube one at a time. Leading the way, I emerged on another level of the ship. Gold Deck was eerie. I'd been up here on a number of occasions, and there'd always been a pack of staffers bustling around in perfectly creased uniforms. Now the place was deserted. Spread out, I directed my squad as they popped out of the tube behind me. Search and confirm we're secure.
Vet?
Kiwi asked in a hushed voice.
Shouldn't there be some dead people? There were a few in the passages, but...
Actually, I said, there were none. The corpses we saw were really empty suits of armor. The bodies themselves are all missing. She gave me a worried glance. I headed for the central consoles, and she stuck close behind me. We tried to engage the power couplings, but failed.
No juice, Kiwi said. The power cables have been cut off somewhere between here and the generators.
Where are the generators?
Engineering.
No one had much to say to that. Engineering, or Red Deck, was where the breach had originally occurred. Most of Graves's troops were headed there now. We all had visions of high radiation, holes in the core shielding, and hard vacuum that couldn't be easily sealed off. Reluctantly, I contacted Graves. Centurion McGill reporting, we've reached and secured Gold Deck. It's a ghost town. The bad news is we've got no power up here for the control systems. Any chance of getting a feed from engineering?
Negative, McGill, Graves said. We're nowhere near reaching our target yet. We've encountered a lot of damaged areas of the ship. Debris, exposed radioactives, collapsed passages, you name it. We might have to spacewalk to get there at all.
Okay then, sir, I said. Should we hold our position here until you can get through?
No, I've got a better idea. Take your squad down to support Adjunct Toro. She's trying to get into Blue Deck and she's having some kind of problem.
Will do, sir. We almost left before I remembered my special orders from Tribune Drusus and Turov. They'd ordered me directly to take this part of the ship. In fact, they'd asked me to locate a specific locker on Gold Deck. Clanking to the spot, I opened the locker. Sure enough, there was a spanking new walking vehicle we called a Dragon inside.
Looks like it's in good condition, Carlos commented.
It is, I said thoughtfully. I mounted the Dragon's back plate and got a surprise. The Dragon wasn't empty. There was a body inside. It had to be the first intact dead body I'd seen since I'd boarded Minotaur. The shocker was that the corpse was none other than Imperata Turov herself. Carlos, get up here, I ordered. Carlos scrambled to my position and looked her over.
She died in the pilot's harness, he said. She doesn't have a respirator. Looks like she was overcome before she could seal up the Dragon.
Yeah, I said thoughtfully. What I don't get is why she didn't mention during the briefing that this is where she died.
Maybe she doesn't know how it ended, he suggested. The ship's systems were failing all over the place. Maybe her final moments aboard the ship weren't recorded. Anyway, let's pull her out of there. I'll drive the Dragon for you, Vet.
I glanced at him and snorted. Fat chance. I'm driving this thing.
It felt strange to handle Galena's corpse. After all, I'd made love to this woman a number of times over the last few days. But here she was, dead as a doornail and frozen stiff in the vacuum. We set her aside, gently, and I climbed into the Dragon and reached for the controls that would fire up the vehicle. But then I remembered something and stopped. Galena had possessed a very valuable item, an artifact that was quite possibly unique in all of Frontier 921. The Galactic Key.
Chapter 44. The Galactic Key was a forbidden tool. It was a piece of technology that set our alien masters apart from all the lowly beings that eked out a living along the rim of the Empire. The key could enable or disable any Imperial-approved alien-made device. Anything that was built by one world for use on another had to include a bypass system that only the Galactics were supposed to be able to use. Physically, the key didn't look like a key. It looked more like a seashell. But that appearance belied its power. In the Galactic Empire, any technology that was worth having was traded between worlds. Once a given star system exhibited that they had the best version of that item, such as a snap rifle, revival machine, or even a starship, they had the exclusive rights to market it in their region of the Empire. That was all well and good, and these simple trade laws made the Empire work even with thousands of diverse cultures. However, the races known collectively as the Galactics were special. They lived in the core systems, and they were our masters. To maintain their dominance, they liked to keep a few tricks up their sleeves. One of these tricks was their keys. Using a key, a Galactic like one of the Magua could bypass security and operate anything they liked, even if they didn't own it. That meant they could board a starship like Minotaur at will, or even fire her guns if they felt the urge. Looking down at Galena's dead body, I couldn't help but wonder, could she have the key on her?
"Oh, for God's sake, McGill," Keevy said with her hands planted on her hips. "Don't tell me you're losing it over this woman's dead body. You've seen me dead often enough."
Carlos chuckled. "Keevy's right. I've never seen you look this broken up over her corpse, not even when it was fresh."
Keevy slapped him, and then she glared at me.
I said, trying to think. The trouble was, I couldn't tell them about the key. They didn't know it existed. It was a secret that only Claver, Turov, and I shared. The reason I was staring at the corpse had nothing to do with grief. I was wondering if Galena had died with the key on her person. Had she sent me here, hoping I'd find it for her? If that was the case, why hadn't she told me that was the nature of my mission? Uncertainly, I leaned over and began to search her pockets.
"This is disgusting," Keevy said, misinterpreting my actions.
"Shut up, specialist," I said. "I'm trying to see if she has the activator for the Dragon on her."
"You don't need that," she snapped. "The Dragon will recognize you. It's got a computer inside, you know."
Then I found it, a bulge in her left hip pocket. Fishing in there, I tried to pull it out while hunkering over her body to hide what I was doing. The damn thing was stuck in her pocket.
"McGill, you're mental," Keevy said.
She stalked away, but Carlos hung around. "You want me to get you to a room?" he asked.
"Shut up, man," I said. "I've got special orders."
"I bet you do."
"Give me your knife," I said.
"Sick puppy," he said, but he handed me his belt knife anyway. I slashed Galena's hip pocket open and immediately saw the problem. The key was a small device, but she'd secured it in her pocket in a pouch of some kind.
It was tied down so she couldn't lose it accidentally. I cut the cords and then I stood up, thinking hard.
"What's that thing?"
Carlo